Help us celebrate our 200th story and 100,000th plus download for 2020. On October 18th, join us live on Facebook at makeshiftstories.sci-fi as we record our bicentenary episode starting at 0100 GMT. In North America, that's 9 p.m. Atlantic, 8 p.m. Eastern, 7 p.m. Central, 6 p.m. Mountain, and 5 p.m. Pacific. Details are in the show notes.
Is there a place in time where logic breaks down and wonderment begins? Could that be somewhere or sometime along an indefinable line between the reasonable and highly unlikely? Makeshift Stories presents a monthly journey into the improbable.
Today's story, 199, Escape from Haven, Part 1. Read by Mitchell Two. Audio post-production by Matthew Erdman. Somewhere and sometime, we might start to realize what unites us is more important than what separates us. As soon as Carl turned the corner and was out of sight of the last security check, he let out a breath he hadn't realized he had been holding. He risked taking a glance back to ensure none of the sentinels had decided to follow him, then picked up his pace to catch up to the rest of the workers from Haven. He felt the irrational need to blend in, despite being disguised in a skin. The synthetic biological epidermis had been grown from a few cells he had surreptitiously harvested from one of his family's so-called personal attendants. They were, as he now knew, as fake as his new epidermis. He had discovered the deception a few months before he came up with his plan to escape Haven, and Haven was as phony as the people he was trying to catch up to, who pretended they were servers, cooks, and gardeners, when they were, in fact, prison guards. Carl only felt a modicum of remorse for the man whose skin he had sampled. The guy would eventually make it to shore, so they would inevitably realize two John Hamiltons had passed through the scanners. But by then, he planned on assuming a new identity and vanishing into the ever-growing masses of Hinterland. The artificial epidermis was the only way to hide the generic marker all residents, aka inmates, of Haven had been tagged with. He had learned bits and pieces of the truth from the so-called house staff he feigned to befriend, convincing them he wasn't like the others. He wasn't a predator that would consume the world if he ever got out. One day, the pretend family chauffeur inadvertently revealed enough to be blackmailed into helping him. The organic replicators had probably cost her a year's salary. Given her reaction to his demands, he assumed if she was caught, she'd probably end up in some place like Haven. Now that he knew the truth, Carl suspected there had to be other isolation zones. At least, that's what any resident of Haven would set up if they were in control. The thought made Carl smile. If Hinterland was full of easily manipulated people like the chauffeur, life beyond the island would be interesting indeed. Finally, catching up to the lemmings in front of him, Carl slipped into their midst as they streamed out the main door of the security building and into the busy streets. He felt like a fox in the henhouse. Gwen squinted, trying to make out the face of the person on the grainy screen. This was the first John Hamilton. He came through port security with the Haven shift change on Wednesday. Odessa, the Port Authority security officer, noted as she touched the screen to switch videos. The new view showed an exhausted man lying on the bed in a small holding room. This is John Hamilton too. He showed up yesterday on a beach down the coast, claiming he had been pushed over the side of the Haven ferry. His attacker must have thrown him a lifesaver, otherwise he wouldn't be here. Did he see who pushed him? Gwen asked automatically, moving closer to the screen so she could scrutinize the image. It certainly does look like the same guy, but there are differences. You're right, Gwen. Hamilton 1 is a bit taller and heavier than number 2. However, both passed through the scanners. Neither had the marker. Just to be safe, we've contacted Haven to check if any of the residents are missing. But even if there are, it might not mean anything. Record-keeping and security has gotten slack out there. With the marker, no one believes it's possible to escape. At least up to now. They're scanned at both ends, you see. The system is thought to be foolproof. So, unfortunately, the scanners were never designed to flag two people with the same DNA. So how did Hamilton 1 get past the scans? We assume he was wearing a synthetic epidermis, a skin suit. It's new tech used to help burn victims. If that is what he used, it's a first. We're just guessing here, but logically, that's the only way he could have gotten through. Gwen sighed, falling back into her chair. Can I see the first Hamilton again? Sure. Odessa touched an icon on the screen and backed away to watch. Hamilton casually approached the scanner and stood as the machine examined him. It always took a minute for the thing to analyze the results. Stop there, Gwen requested. Was his heart rate elevated? A bit, but that's not uncommon. Have you ever been scanned, Gwen? It's not exactly pleasant. Okay, so this guy uses a skin suit to get through, but where would he get an organic replicator? I didn't think Haven was even permitted to know about new technology like that. They aren't, so obviously an attendant helped him, Gwen. And that's where you'll have to start. Organic replicators are single use. I assume this guy knew we'd eventually find the real Hamilton, so he'll need to acquire another one from his collaborator to change identities. I've pulled a list of people currently doing their civic duty in Haven. It's long. Sorry. Odessa pushed a data cube at Gwen, who picked it up and turned it over in her hand thoughtfully. If we knew who he was, it would help to narrow down the list. To a tendency at direct contact with. When and if we find out, I'll let you know. Odessa sighed. But I wouldn't hold my breath. Carl found it hard not to stare as he walked away from the port security building. Hinterland was not what he had expected. For generations, he and everyone else on Haven had grown up believing they were the elite, running the world from a safe enclave in the middle of the Pacific Ocean. They had been taught that beyond the mists which hid Haven from unwanted attention, the world was an overcrowded, industrial wasteland whose lazy, unfortunate residents lacked the wherewithal to better themselves. But what he was seeing made that belief just another lie, intended to keep the residents. No, he now thought of them as inmates, and himself as an escapee, unaware of their true situation. Haven was a sham. Carl acknowledged it had originally lived up to its name, a place of refuge for people who could afford to live in the subtropical paradise and isolate themselves from the problems of the world. But at some point, and he was not clear about when it happened, Haven had been transformed from refuge to prison, without anyone on the island realizing something fundamental had changed. The information flowing back to Haven continued to show a version of the world the residents expected. Financial transactions, board meetings, directives all continued as if nothing had happened. Meanwhile, the world had turned its back on them and moved on. Once Carl had pieced together the truth, he had briefly been tempted to tell everyone on Haven. However, he realized if he did, there would be thousands of elites like him, hungry to regain the power they had been cheated out of. So instead, he kept the truth to himself. That way, he had no competition, and the world would be his alone. He stopped at a prosperous-looking fruit vendor, pretending to be interested in the peaches. He had been attracted to the stand because of a man who was approximately his height and build, examining a basket of apples. Carl slipped in beside the man and greeted the proprietor.
Hey, those peaches look great. Are they fresh?
He inquired, putting on a charismatic smile.
Best I've ever seen. Did you grow them yourself?
They're my cousins. I picked them yesterday in the valley.
The proprietor boasted, offering a tray of samples for Carl to try. Carl fumbled a particularly juicy slice off the plate, purposefully losing control of it, so the thing squirted out of his hand and into the apple bin.
Oh, I'm sorry about that.
Carl apologized, reaching past the man beside him, his hand briefly brushing a forearm. The sampler, hidden in a ring, painlessly vacuumed off a few skin cells.
I'm so sorry, he apologized again.
I'll take 6,
Carl said to the proprietor and pressed his thumb on the credit reader, half expecting it to be rejected. When the machine chirped its acceptance, he knew the real Hamilton hadn't been found yet. However, the clock was running down. Using the skin's credit was a risk, but he needed the cell sample, and once he switched IDs, the trail would go cold.
In a bag, please, he asked and smiled again.
The man beside him left in disgust. The proprietor, obviously blaming Carl for a lost sale, scowled, then finally nodded and placed the fruit into a brown paper bag. Carl thanked her, then turned and headed for the drop point. He wanted to switch skins as soon as possible. Gwen was feeling at a loss as she scanned through the list of Haven attendants. There were over 500 names. Assuming the fake Hamilton would have had to have been in contact with the attendant or attendants who helped him more than once, she had eliminated the names of people who had just finished their first shift at the Enclave, which still left over 200 leads to follow. It would take weeks to interview all of them, and by then, the escapee would be long gone. It was a unique situation. There was little need for investigators in the port, and the role had, over the years, become almost ceremonial, kept in place more as a matter of good form than necessity. When she accepted the position as an alternative to performing her public service on Haven as an attendant, she had never imagined she'd actually be called on. Unlike attendants, who were randomly selected and served a maximum of 4 shifts to fulfill their civic responsibility, her appointment was for 5 years. As Odessa at Port Security had noted, this was the first breakout attempt in living memory. It just happened to occur while Gwen was the investigator designate, which made her wonder just how serious a threat one escapee was and how much damage he could do if she failed to find him. Gwen, like everyone in Hinterland, knew the story by heart. Through nursery rhymes, fables, and games, Haven had been woven into the fabric of their lives so completely it was impossible to imagine a world without it. Haven, before anyone called it that, was just an island, remote enough to isolate its inhabitants from the economic and environmental ravages burning across the globe at the time, like an out-of-control wildfire. The island's reputation as a safe refuge grew as the global crisis accelerated, attracting those with the means and power to relocate and control their interests remotely. The new residents of the isolated landmass started calling it Safe Haven, which was later shortened to Haven. Gwen noted no one seemed to remember the original name of the place. That history had been completely erased. The change did not occur overnight and did not radiate out from a single point. The idea seemed to occur everywhere at once. With no physical presence on the ground, the island's population, some would later compare to kings and queens from the Middle Ages, were completely dependent on data, and data could be faked. So, in a bloodless coup, hackers began to feed the island false information and manipulate the wealthy and powerful who had not yet joined their cohort to pack up and move there. The final step was to identify the common genetic and psychological traits of the elite, then isolate those who appeared in the general population and exile them as well on the pretense of joining the world's leaders in Haven. Then, and only then, did the people left behind begin to see what they had in common, rather than how they were different. They discovered their differences had been intentionally magnified to prevent exactly what had just happened. The common belief was that it would only take one rotten seed to set the world back onto the disastrous course it had barely escaped. But Gwen wasn't so sure as she scanned the list of names, again wondering where to start. The comms patch on her wrist, a thin, organic screen grown from modified skin cells, lit up with a message notification. "Accept," Gwen verbalized, then heard Odessa's excited voice in her ear. "He used Hamilton's credit." An hour later, Gwen found herself standing in front of a modest fruit stand about 3 blocks from the port. The proprietor was a tall, handsome woman with dark hair and skin etched by the harsh sun, like everyone who spent their days outside. The holes in the ozone layer were still recovering even 3 generations after the world had turned its back on Haven, Gwen reminded herself.
"Hi there," the stand owner beckoned to Gwen. "We have some great strawberries today if you're interested."
"They look awesome, but I'm not here to buy."
The proprietor eyed her suspiciously.
"I'm the inspector designate,"
Gwen offered a hand in greeting. The woman instinctively tensed. The unannounced appearance of an inspector was as rare as hen's teeth, so the proprietor's reaction was understandable. Gwen tried to soften her introduction.
"I'm just a person like you, on leave from my family's business to perform my civic duties."
The woman appeared to relax a bit.
"As part of that, I'm looking for a man who may have visited your stand yesterday. That's all. I just need to confirm he was here. Can I show you a photo?"
The woman nodded and accepted the flex screen Gwen unrolled and handed to her. She hesitated, then angled the screen to reduce the glare.
"Yeah, I remember. He was here, I'm pretty sure. He was the one who dropped the sample I gave him. It'll still be on my shop cam. Do you want the recording?"
"Sure," Gwen shrugged.
"Thanks, it might be helpful. Please send it to my screen. Oh, did he say anything about where he was going?"
"Nope."
The woman placed a small memory cube on the flex screen, then waited for the transfer to complete. Gwen nodded and thanked her. It had been over a day since Hamilton 1 had been there, so he could be anywhere now. And if he had another replicator waiting, well, he could look like anyone. The lead was a dead end. Disappointed, she left. The park surprised Carl. In Haven, they had been led to believe the ignorant masses of Hinterland were too caught up in the practicality of daily affairs to appreciate aesthetics. Everything had been supposedly reduced to utilitarian necessity and the lowest common denominator. But this place, and for that matter, everything Carl had seen, was a stunning contradiction to what he had been taught. He was standing in a garden of unimaginable beauty, which integrated human and natural elements in perfect harmony. Carl had to force himself to refocus on the task at hand. All the paths wandering through the park met at a central pond bordered by a low brick retaining wall. Each brick was engraved with the name of a deceased friend or relative. It was a memorial. Carl worked his way around the pond, keeping an eye on the people who passed by, enjoying the sunny day. He tried to mimic their casual disinterest in the bricks until he found the name Janice Foley. He waited until no one was looking, then tried to dig his nails into the soft mortar holding the brick in place, then squeezed and pulled. But the thing resisted and didn't budge. Carl stopped tugging and stood up as a group of kids walked by. He fished in his pockets for something to pry with. Finding nothing, he looked around and finally spotted a stout-looking stick on the other side of the path encircling the wall. Pretending to examine the nearby flowers, he surreptitiously bent over and picked up the makeshift tool. Another group of kids, accompanied by an adult, walked by staring at him. Carl sat down on a bench and waited while the group disappeared up one of the trails winding back into the park. When they were out of sight, he quickly moved back to the place in the wall where the brick was located and used the stick to pry the stubborn thing out, revealing an empty cavity. Carl cursed and angrily slammed a fist into the wall, ripping his synthetic skin, causing his knuckles to bleed. It wouldn't be hard to find his apparently unreliable collaborator, but contacting her would put him at risk. However, port security would surely have the real Hamilton by now, so they would know what he looked like. He needed another organic replicator. He had no choice. To be continued.
Makeshift Stories is a proud member of the Alberta Podcast Network, locally grown, community supported. To listen to other great APN podcasts, such as Bollywood is for Lovers, where Matt Bowes and Aaron Fraser explore the world of Hindi cinema, head over to albertapodcastnetwork.com. This episode of Makeshift Stories is brought to you by the Explore Podcast, a new fiction anthology podcast brought to you by Jupiter Theater with Media Lab YYC. Each episode takes an imaginative dive into the past and future of your city, transporting you to fictional worlds that mirror our own through music and the power of the voice. The stories will immerse you in rich audio dramas while you explore the world through a new lens. Grab your headphones and set off on an urban adventure into the city through stories of speculative fiction, with episodes ranging from film noir and magical realism to urban fantasy and indigenous mythology. Listen to Explore on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. And visit theaterjupiter.com/explore to find out more. We'd like to also tell you about what's new with our friends at Storyhive. Since 2013, TELUS Storyhive has funded productions and supported emerging filmmakers with mentorship and guidance from the National Screen Institute. The Storyhive program has brought hundreds of films to life from creators in Western Canada. Storyhive is committed to supporting underrepresented filmmakers and stories, which is why we want you to jump on this opportunity. Storyhive's documentary edition is back, and this one is all about local heroes. They're looking for documentary pitches from Alberta residents that highlight extraordinary citizens in your community, big or small. Successful pitches will receive $20,000 and customized mentorship to produce their product. Applications are open until October 7th at 1 p.m. Mountain Time. Check the eligibility requirements and apply now on storyhive.com. Makeshift Stories is released twice a month around the 1st and the 15th. This month's story was written by Alan V. Hare and read by Mitchell Too. Audio post-production by Matthew Erdman. Opening and closing themes were composed and recorded by David Hume. To find out more about David, head over to davidhume.me. If you'd like to connect with us, please send an email to makeshiftstories@gmail.com or visit our website at makeshiftstories.com. Links to both are in the show notes. You can help us out by subscribing on Apple Podcasts or any of your favorite podcast services. Makeshift Stories is released under a Creative Commons non-commercial attribution, no derivative license, which means you are free to share our stories. Just remember to credit us and don't alter anything.